You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
The Berkeley Free Speech Movement and the Erosion of Free Speech by Steve Simpson.
I want to start off by lodging a protest. These afternoon events or afternoon time slots are shorter than they used to be, and I regard that as a flagrant violation of my rights. I'm being censored. If you actually agree with what I just said, you're definitely in the right room. All right, so the Berkeley Free Speech Movement and the Erosion of Free Speech, let's just jump right in here because we don't have all that much time. So in, I hope most people have heard about the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, but and I'll talk in greater detail, but let me just introduce you to it this way. In 1964, in the fall semester, University of California, Berkeley, there was what many have come to call, and I think correctly so, an uprising on the campus of Berkeley. The short version is that in response to a university ban on campaigning, basically on campus, on political activity on campus, students became very upset and they staged protests, mass civil disobedience, sit-ins, they occupied university property, and this went on for the entire semester. And it really captured the university community for the entire semester. It was really the focal point of the whole semester. And at the end of that semester, and I'll give you more details on this, the university basically caved and gave the students what they wanted. And it has since then become widely known as an important victory for free speech. And this is just widely known throughout the country. The movement went not only from, or it started at Berkeley, but it spread to other campuses. And it was part of really the protest movement of the 1960s and is widely regarded as a huge victory for free speech. Now, I'll tell you, as I said, more details about what actually happened and my view of it. But in the meantime, or first, before I get to that, I want to fast forward to 2017, where something also happened on the campus of Berkeley, and what I'm referring to, and this is also regarded as at least important for free speech, albeit in a different way than the Berkeley Free Speech Movement is viewed, and what I'm referring to is the riot that occurred at Berkeley on February 1st of 2017 in response to the scheduled appearance of alt-right provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, which probably most of you have heard of Milo. He was scheduled to speak there, and a lot of students and individuals from groups like Antifa and Black Bloc opposed that, and protesters, rioters, incited a riot. They basically rioted to prevent Milo from speaking. They knocked down police barricades, they set fires, and then for good measure, they ran through the town and broke all the windows of all the banks, because the banks are really the center of evil in the country. And if you're going to do anything in this country, you got to go after the banks. No, I'm kidding about that. But I mean, it was a real riot on campus. And then for the rest of the semester, there were a number of kind of skirmishes, you could think about it as, over freedom of speech. I'll just give you a couple highlights. Ann Coulter was scheduled to speak at Berkeley. And because of the violence that occurred in response to Milo, they had to cancel. They ended up canceling her talk. This upset a lot of people. Later on, Ben Shapiro was supposed to talk in the fall, and there was some question about whether he was going to be allowed to. And ultimately, Berkeley spent $600,000 in security to have Shapiro speak. Now, as I said, this is the first, the 64 protests was seen as a huge boon for free speech. This the second protest, so to speak, was seen as the opposite of free speech. It was a betrayal of the principles of what the Berkeley Free Speech Movement supposedly stood for, and that's what I want to examine. Here's the reaction to what happened at Berkeley in 2017, free speech battle at the birthplace of a movement at Berkeley. That was the New York Times. Washington Post, Berkeley gave birth to a free speech movement, now conservatives are demanding to include them. So the idea, of course, is this is all about free speech. If you don't include us, That's a betrayal of free speech. Let me just. And then finally, and I think this really captures the Berkeley paradox, the birthplace of free speech, now offended by it. Now, these are mainstream views of what's happening at Berkeley in 2017. And the question I want to focus on is this view correct? Is it right or is it true that what happened at Berkeley in 2017 is a betrayal of the principles of what happened in 1964? And my answer, well, I disagree with this, but I want to explain why I do. I actually think that they're both essentially the same thing. But that's kind of what I want to explore. So one way you could think about it is taking a look at the protest movement both on and off campus through the lens of what happened at Berkeley and the way people evaluate what happened at Berkeley. So another way to put it, the current view or the common view today is that this, which is 2017, does not equal this. And as I said, my view is a bit different than that, but I want to get into and explain why that is. Now, before I get to that, I should talk a little bit, just spend a couple minutes on why does the Berkeley free speech movement even matter? Who cares what happened in 1964? I mean, it was a long time ago. What impact does it have today? And my answer is really two things. One is similar things are happening on campus today, similar things to what happened in 1964, and especially similar things to what happened in 2017. We're seeing a lot of these. So on campus, a few examples. Charles Murray was attacked at Middlebury College in 2017. 2017 was a big year for people getting attacked on campus and having riots. Not surprisingly, I think, because Donald Trump had just taken office and it was a momentous event. But Charles Murray, Heather McDonald at Claremont McKenna, basically, protesters blocked her from even having an audience. She had to be whisked away later because there were fears that she'd be attacked. Brett Weinstein at Evergreen State. If you followed what happened at Evergreen State in Washington, protesters basically took over the whole campus. I've talked to Brett Weinstein about this. And he said basically he was barred from campus by the campus police because protesters had taken over the campus. And then if we look both before and after, this is a picture of the University of Missouri protests back in 2015. And these things have happened at a number of other schools and on and off campus. And the Berkeley free speech movement and the whole idea that of protest movements being equivalent to free speech definitely has an impact on how people view these, and I think the frequency of them. It's what happened at Berkeley you can take as a kind of example of a view of free speech that is very, very flawed. And that's what we need to, that's what I want to focus on and why that's happening. Now, I also want to ask another question, which is, so what's going on, right? We can ask the question, why is this happening? Everybody say it together. Snowflakes. I'm glad that you picked up on that for two reasons. One, I'd be hurt if you didn't understand what the slide was all about. But also, I think that explanation is completely wrong and really pretty silly. Now, I know it's very popular to point to what's happening on campuses and say, oh, it's just snowflakes. It's a bunch of sensitive people. That doesn't really tell us much. Now, there is something to the idea, I think, that college students are a little bit more sensitive. But it's not much of an explanation. If you talk to people who actually teach on campus or go to college, you'll get very mixed reviews of this. This idea that it's just about college snowflakes is far too facile. It doesn't tell us anything. And it's really just a kind of epithet that, you know, conservatives now hurl at supposedly liberal college kids on campus. Now, there are much better explanations. One is ideas, bad ideas. I'm not really going to spend a lot of time talking about this, but I just want to flag the fact that this all comes back to ideas and two of the prevalent ideas, multiculturalism and irrationalism. You can think of it as tribalism and then a rejection of reason. And think if people reject reason, there's a widespread rejection of free will today. If you really believe we don't have free will, what the hell is the point of having a conversation? Because I'm trying to convince you of something. If you can't choose to agree with me, there is no point in having free speech. But what I want to focus on for the remainder of the talk is really that there is this widespread misunderstanding of freedom of speech in America. And it's an interesting thing. I mean, it is easy to think that freedom of speech is an easy issue to understand. It is not really an easy issue to understand. It's easy to think that most people either support free speech or understand the nature of the right to free speech, what it includes and what it covers and what it does not cover, but there is widespread misunderstanding about this. Let me point out to you or promote, Ayn Rand wrote an essay on the Berkeley free speech movement called The Cashing In, the Student Rebellion. And it's so I'll say this a few more times during my talk. Definitely read that essay. But she talks about so much in that essay, and it's so rich in detail and analysis of this event, and really talks a whole lot about what is going wrong with our conception of free speech. And it's amazing to know that back then people didn't understand the issues she was talking about. Even today, many people don't really understand what's going on with this issue. So we absolutely need to understand free speech in order to preserve it. So that's a large part of the reason that I'm doing this. So, another way to put it is, if you look at the protests today, this is two pictures of basically another riot that happened in Berkeley after the Milo riot, but there are many others. Charlottesville is a great example. One simple way to think about why this matters is, if this is what people look at, if this is what people think free speech looks like, and I'll give you some other pictures that look even worse than this, if they really think of Charlottesville, clashing gangs and death, as that's what free speech requires, I say they will reject free speech. I'm a big fan of free speech, and I would probably even reject free speech if that's really what it meant, but it's not what it means. So the basic points I want to cover, I want to give you a little bit of background on what happened at Berkeley in 64. It's worth knowing that there are lessons to be learned about what happened there, but it's also just good, because this is constantly brought up as an important victory for free speech, just to know the facts of it. Second, I want to talk about what the meaning of the movement and then the broader protest movement is, and what are the implications of it, and what's wrong with it, and then ultimately, you know, what are the bad ideas that come out of that, and how do we combat them? What's the correct way of thinking about this? So let's start talking about Berkeley. I just want to give you some details. I'm not going to give you all of the nuts and bolts of everything that happened there. I just want to give you the basic outline, and then I'll compare it to some things that are happening today. So this is a picture of a guy by the name of Mario Savio standing on top of a police car on October 1st, 1964, addressing a group of students that they're surrounding the police car because the police arrested a protester there. But let me give you a bit of background on it. So what the whole thing at Berkeley comes down to, a dispute about political campaigning on campus. It's kind of funny to think that all of this happened for an entire semester. You had mass civil disobedience, all because the university told students that they couldn't engage in political activity. And by political activity, I don't mean talking about candidates. I mean they really couldn't actively campaign for candidates on the university grounds, and I'll explain why a bit later. But what the university did is relegate them all to a strip of sidewalk right outside of the front gate. So they basically allowed them to engage in political activity right outside the front gate, not on the college campus. During the semester, the university changed that policy and basically said you can't even engage in campaigning there. One might ask, why didn't you just move down a block down the street? What's the big deal? And I actually think that's a valid point. But in any event, students were upset. Now, it seems a little bit silly, and I have a tendency to make fun of young people, especially now that I'm in my 50s. But we can understand at least this much. It was an election year. The civil rights movement was in full swing, and we were just getting involved in Vietnam. So there were a lot of things going on that students might be upset about and they want to talk about. So it's understandable that kids want to do this kind of thing, although the way they did it and everything they they did ultimately was wrong. So they oppose this policy. They start ignoring the policy. They conclude that the student is catering to outside, sorry, that the university is catering to outside interests. They thought that businesses in the town were complaining to the university and essentially preventing the students from, or prevailing on the university to prevent students from engaging in political activity. And that's not, there's actually a lot of truth to that, but I'll speak more about it. So on October 1st, as I mentioned, a guy by the name of Jack Weinberg basically violates the policy and he's arrested. He engages in political activity on campus. Police arrest him. He basically goes limp. This is an ex-civil rights worker. He's adopting the tactics of Martin Luther King. He goes limp. And then the story is 400 students spontaneously protest, leading to a 34-hour. I always put spontaneously in quotes because it always struck me as a little weird that it's just 400 people were hanging around waiting for this to happen. I wish I could control 400 students like that and just make them do what I want them to. But who knows? Maybe it was spontaneous money. Maybe it wasn't. But in any event, you get this massive protest. I'll go back to this. This is what happens. That many students surround the cop car, and then you have a 30-hour standoff in which Weinberg sits in the car and the students protest. And it's just this mass, you know, mass protest, mass civil disobedience. Finally, they solve it. But for the rest of the semester now, you have these kinds of skirmishes going on. So this is the steps of Sproul Plaza at UC Berkeley, if you've ever been there. But this is the kind of thing that is happening on a weekly basis at Berkeley. There are mass sit-ins in administrative offices. The largest number of students ever, I think, arrested on campus are arrested. 800 students are arrested and actually prosecuted during this. And this continues for the entire semester. So you have, I've already said that. And the students and the university are essentially negotiating what should happen. Should the university prevail? Should the students prevail? Should the university continue to prosecute students who engage in this kind of civil disobedience? The ultimate end result is, and this is the sort of victory march out the front gates, the university caves. It ultimately says, okay, we give, you get your way, and you can engage in political activity on campus now. And that's you know, from there, you get the movement moving to other campuses, other student groups, and other students in other campuses engaging in the same kind of activity from there on out. But that's the gist of it. It was a battle over political campaigning on campus in which the students engaged in mass civil disobedience, and they ended up winning. The university caved. So the takeaway from this, and I kind of gave you a little bit of a flavor of that before from the headlines, but this is what I would call the romanticized or common view, but it's an idealized or a romanticized view, at least in a conventional sense, of the Berkeley protests. So faceless bureaucrats trample students' free speech rights, adopting the tactics of the civil rights movement. Students bravely put their bodies on the line and win a victory for free speech. I think this is real. I mean, if you learn about this in school, if you read about it in books, mainstream takes on this, this is essentially what you get. That, I mean, leave aside, okay, faceless bureaucrats, probably true, right? But trampling students' free speech rights, that they're essentially equivalent to the civil rights protesters in the South, that there's a way to, you know, draw a parallel between people fighting state-sponsored racism and segregation, and a bunch of students who are upset about, you know, a political ban on campus, and that this is a great victory for free speech. I would put it, other than the faceless bureaucrats part, every part of this is wrong. Every single part of this is completely wrong. And it is corrosive to our view of free speech if we accept this as the proper interpretation of Berkeley and of other movements like that. So here's a little bit more context. And this context is relevant to more than just what happened at Berkeley, and I'll explain why. Because it's necessary not just to know the facts of what happened at Berkeley, but to think more broadly about what happens when we get these kinds of mass protests on public property, typically, or on universities, whether they're private or public. So additional context, the students were using the university as a staging area to conduct sit-ins at local businesses. This is why, so it was actually, it's accurate that local businesses were upset. But the way I put it is, I understand why they were upset. So, and keep in mind that these are businesses that are among the people in California who are paying for the university. At that time, although this isn't, I think this is an interesting fact, tuition at Berkeley was essentially free for California students and almost free for out-of-state students. Now, that in itself isn't absolutely crucial to what I'm saying. It is crucial to know that students are going, and they were staging sit-ins at local businesses over civil rights issues. Whether they were right or wrong is really irrelevant. I can talk more to that. But the bottom line is, the people who are paying for the existence of the university have to watch a bunch of students use the university as their staging ground to essentially come violate the property rights of those businesses. If it were me, I'd be a little tired of that too. And the broader point is this. There's really two points. One is, and I'll get into this more, we've got to take the idea of property rights seriously when it comes to free speech. And we certainly have to recognize, even when we're talking about public property, a public university or a public space, it isn't your property. You can't have a right to treat that property any way you want. And if you do, your rights and your interests are going to clash with other people's. And this is a perfect example of what happens when you don't respect property rights or you don't have a proper regime of property rights. You get inherent clashes. And finally, the ban on political activity was entirely sensible. It was just an application of the general principle that we should not mix government money or taxpayers' money or government jobs and political activity. That's a widespread ban at both the federal and the state level. The university banned political activity at Berkeley because it was trying to be sensible and respect the line between campaigning and government. So a more sensible view, in my view, of the Berkeley protests, it was a massive violation of other people's property rights or other people's rights, taxpayers' rights, other students. It occupied the attention of the university for an entire semester for a relatively small group of people who essentially held the rest of the university hostage. And this kind of thing, again, if you look at other protests on campus or other protests in the public square, people never pay attention to what about the rest of the people who live in Charlottesville? What about everybody else that's on this campus and just wants to learn? It was mass lawlessness. There is this romanticized view in this country that it is okay to violate the law if you have a really good reason, and especially if it has something to do with, quote, civil rights. That is just not true. And I can expand on that a bit more if people want to ask me questions about when is it proper or not proper morally to do that. It can't be proper legally to do that. What that means is government essentially is sanctioning the violation of its own laws, saying it's fine to violate and ignore our laws. You cannot have that and have a civilized society. It was an intimidation tactic. That's what a massed act of civil disobedience is. It's an effort to intimidate another person or group of people. That is not an effort to try to talk to people. Those students amassed in that square were not trying to have a conversation with the university and say, you know, we don't agree with this policy, maybe you should change that policy. And I think every single example of a mass protest like this is that. It was the use of force. It was not an example of freedom of speech. That is what we need to understand about this. Now, let me expand on this a bit. What is the meaning of what comes out of the Berkeley free speech movement, as I put it, the protest movement, a lot of the protests that we're seeing today. Now, let me start with, I mentioned Ayn Rand's essay, The Cashing in the Student Rebellion. I want to read just two quotes about that and think about what she's talking about here and whether or not what she's saying has, in some sense, come true. So, as she put it, the main ideological purpose of the Berkeley uprising was to, quote, condition the country to accept force as the means of settling disputes, to accept force as better than persuasion, better than discussion, better than, you know, an exchange of ideas. A society that tolerates intimidation, I talked about mass civil disobedience as an effort at intimidation, to settle disputes, the physical intimidation of some men or groups by others, loses its moral right to exist as a social system, and its collapse does not take long to follow. Ask yourself this, what is the fundamental purpose of government, even from a totally conventional standpoint? Right, so we would put it as protecting rights, barring force among men. Most people wouldn't put it that way, but they would say maintaining order, you know, enforcing the criminal law, and if they thought about it, they'd get that, yeah, there's the difference between me and other people, and I have to be able to own stuff, and I have property, I have to be safe, right? If government forfeits that, if it essentially allows lawlessness to take place on a massive scale, it's lost the moral reason, it's lost the reason to have a government. Why have a government if it essentially just allows people to run wild and violate the law and violate other people's rights? So I think she's right. Loses the moral right to exist, and then its collapse doesn't take long to follow. I don't want to be too dire here, and I don't really think we're on the verge of collapse, but think about the frequency with which these types of protests have taken place. And I'll show you a few in a minute. And how often this happens, and not just how often it happens, it's actually been a while that we've had students blocking speakers on campus and mass protests. But how, I mean, when you hear about these kinds of protests these days, do you really think, oh my God, this is totally out of the ordinary, I can't believe this is happening? I just read, this morning, I read a quick little news blurb on my phone that said that people, protesters are gearing up to protest Trump's immigration policies, which is not that surprising, and who knows what they mean by protest. I mean, maybe they're just gonna speak out against it. And then it said, and here are their demands. Here are their demands. Really, what is this, a hostage situation? That's what people who take hostages do. We're making demands. Remember the Occupy Wall Street movement where all of the various groups had a website, I think it was called The Demands, and they had all these demands that they made on their universities. Essentially it was, if you don't do what we want, we will occupy your property and make your universities utter chaos until you accede to our demands. Now, if that continues to happen, you cannot have a society that continues to function if people are allowed to engage in that kind of lawlessness. So it's a disastrous view of freedom of speech that is embedded in the Berkeley free speech movement and then the entire protest movement leading all the way up to today. Now here's a, so one of the things going wrong here is we're conflating speech with force. The idea that I have the right to engage or use force as a means of expressing myself, force against other people, and that somehow that is included under the general heading of free speech is disastrous. So force starts to seem practical and proper, and speech ultimately comes to be seen as dangerous. So go back to the example I gave earlier of the riots. If you think about Charlottesville, right? If people really view that as what free speech looks like, they're not going to support it anymore. Ayn Rand once said, the bad principles drive out the good. It's also captured in what's known as Gresham's Law, which is about how inflated currency drives out real money because people end up logically hoarding the real money and only using the crappy funny money if they can go buy a gallon of milk with you know, make-believe currency, they're going to do that instead of that something that's valuable. There's a similar kind of logic if you allow force to enter into our everyday affairs. Because why would anybody use speech when they are facing off against somebody who's going to attack them? They really don't have any choice. The only thing that you can use against force is force. You cannot say to somebody who's pointing a gun at you, that's an interesting argument, here's a knife. I have a, because not least because if you're doing that, you're bringing a knife to a gunfight and you always lose. But the point is that it just doesn't work. I mean, once somebody is willing to use force, you have no choice but to use force against them. And it legitimizes the use of force. If we come to see Charlottesville or the various protests as proper, we are legitimizing the use of force against people, which is a deadly circumstance. And then implicit in what I just said, I think, or at least an additional point, there's the idea that speech as a right trumps every other right, or at the very least, trumps property rights. There's this idea that I have if my right to free speech clashes to your right to property, I win, and I'm allowed to speak, and you just have to deal with the fact that I'm violating your property rights. A similar kind of idea is, I'm entitled to speak on any property I want, or I'm entitled to speak on government property because the public owns that property. That's wrong. That is a really, really bad mistake. Now, we can talk about legal issues if you want to, but I want to push that aside and really just talk about the moral, logical point here, which is there can be no right to speak on public property. What I mean is right as an entitlement to take certain kinds of actions simply because you exist. That is not a right. There might be some sort of a legal entitlement with conditions. It's conceivable, and certainly that's one of the ways that the Supreme Court looks at it. But there can't be a right. If you have a right to use public property, everybody has a right to use public property, and what do you get? You get Charlottesville. You get inherent clashes. You have a right to use your property. You don't have a right to use anybody else's property except by, I mean, unless they give you consent. And think about what that does to the right to defend your own rights. So look at the sign, protesting is not rioting. Yeah, kind of. I mean, it depends on what you mean by protesting. And yeah, there's a difference between protesting and rioting. But fundamentally, if we're thinking of protesting as marching on public streets, mass civil disobedience, then they might as well be the same thing. They are species of the same thing. And this is kind of embracing an idea that started at Berkeley, which is to draw a distinction between force, which is fine, and violence, which is bad. So here's an example of the consequences that come out of Berkeley for, I mentioned a couple of the examples. This is Occupy Wall Street on the left, the tent city, and then this is Charlottesville on the right. This is normalizing this kind of thing. If anybody remembers the Occupy Wall Street, this is a private park, although ultimately I don't think it's fundamentally a distinction to say whether it's a private park or a public park, because those guys had absolutely no right to set up their really nice tents in that park, which, as an aside, remember that they were against corporations, banks, and the finance system. I always wanted to say, where'd you get the nice tents from exactly? Where'd they come from? Did you make them yourself? Was it Geppetto and his little... Anyway, so these are two examples of the consequences. Here's another consequence. Now, I think this is worth taking a look at this picture for a moment. This is Charlottesville. And notice something. I mean, this should strike... This was part of the whole Charlottesville protest. This is police in riot gear, and those are the white supremacist, white nationalist protesters, and they are clashing with police. Notice that the one guy, the short guy in the background, has a shield with him. And if you remember, this was a, quote, protest, you know, an example of free speech by a bunch of people who showed up with helmets and signs that they used baseball bats for the sticks, because apparently they just couldn't find any sticks anywhere. I mean, they were prepared for a riot, but there's something deeply, deeply wrong going on if this is seen as a normal exercise of the right to free speech. Police in riot gear clashing with all these guys who are pushing against them and trying to get to their opponents who were the Antifa protesters so that they could basically have a war with them. That's crazy. And no one saw, I mean, people saw the outcome of that as bad. But did they see this fundamentally as crazy and as a logical outgrowth of what the Berkeley free speech movement and a lot of the other protest movements amount to? I think the answer is no. And what happens if we allow this to happen? Does anybody remember who got blamed for Charlottesville? Nobody wanted to blame the judge or our views of free speech or the ACLU, or at least the people who support, I mean, some people did, but who got blamed? It was the police that got blamed. They were the last men standing. Oh, it must be the cops' fault. They didn't referee our gang war, the gang war between the white supremacists and Antifa well enough. They should have kept them separate. It's the cops' fault, which is outrageous. It's wrong. And so it's an example of blaming the victims. If you really take free speech to be the equivalent of doing this sort of thing or violating people's property rights, you are going to end up blaming people who prevent you from doing that, blaming people who create the controversies, even if they're in the right, even if they're correct. That's a horrible, horrible thing. So I think it's worth mentioning an ultimate consequence of this. We can't forget three people died at Charlottesville. The woman, the young woman who was run over by the car, and the two police officers who were killed in the helicopter when it crashed. People die when that is the view of free speech. If we condone this kind of mass civil disobedience and the use of force by one group and another, it's inevitable that this is going to happen. And then ask yourself, how long are people going to say, yeah, that's fine with me. I agree with that view of free speech. I say not very long. So one way to think about it, what is the meaning of Berkeley is mass, quote, civil disobedience in the 1960s ends up in mass uncivil disobedience in the 2000s. These are other examples of protests. You don't have to even think of it as the 2000s or 2017 is a consequence directly of what happened in 1964. The broader point is, if we accept this idea of civil disobedience, mass lawbreaking, the violation or use of spaces that you have no right to use, mass intimidation, then what you get is ultimately uncivil disobedience. And the reason is that the first one wasn't really civil, quote, civil in the first place. All right, so what's the solution? This is obviously a picture of the First Amendment or on a monument marking the First Amendment. But the solution is to understand freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is a right. It's not a trump card, and that's not a pun. That's the term I've used for a long time. It doesn't give you a right to violate the rights of others. We have to understand rights as consistent with one another. The purpose of rights is to solve disputes, not to create them, or to solve and resolve clashes, not to create clashes. And we're finding that we think that some people's rights are conflicting with others. We're making a mistake. Property rights are essential to free speech. You cannot have freedom of speech without respecting property rights. Property rights is one of the material means by which we exercise our free speech. It cannot be that your speech allows you to violate the property rights of others or to take over property that is not yours. You have no right to a forum, audience, or a microphone. So you have the right to speak using your own resources. Nobody owes you a forum, and that includes a public forum. It is not the job of government to provide fora for people to speak. It is embedded in our tradition and our culture in many ways, but it is a real mistake. Think of it as massive subsidies by government to speakers. If you don't think government should be setting up and spending huge amounts of money subsidizing or having public auditoriums or just paying people to subsidize their speech, you shouldn't think government should be providing public spaces for that. Now, this is a really radical idea. Nobody agrees with this outside this room and perhaps even outside the podium. So, but we'll see in a minute. So in summary, action and force are not speech. We absolutely have to maintain that distinction. And it's really the initiation of force is the, but action, we have to regard action as different than speech. Speech is an effort to communicate. And when we're using action, you have to be really careful that you're thinking about it the right way. Some action definitely can convey meaning, but you have to make a sharp distinction. Mass civil disobedience equals intimidation. I mean, there is this culture in this country, or this idea that civil disobedience is a good thing, but if you really think about what that means, it is massive lawlessness. And it cannot be that any country can just condone massive lawlessness or mass acts of lawlessness. It really cannot function. Even if the laws are bad, what you do is you change. I mean, unless you have a dictatorship, in which case, rebellion. But short of rebellion, you have to use civil means to deal with people who disagree with you, even when it's the government. You have to go through proper procedures. As I said, there's no right to violate others. You can sum it all up by saying free speech is the right to speak using your own resources so long as you don't violate the rights of others. That has to be understood. Your own resources. If you didn't earn, in essence, it's you earn the right to speak or you earn the means to speak. And you do it to some extent by having good things to say so that you can attract an audience to listen to you. But nobody owes you that. And if we don't get that, and I have to say, I mean, I have done a lot of speaking over the last couple of years. Nobody understands this point. We take it for granted. Nobody else in the world gets it. All right, so what can you do? I'll wrap up here. One is to read this quote, so long as you have free speech, protect it. This is the life and death issue in this country. Ayn Rand said this in a lecture in 1961. In response to the question, what are the issues we should focus on? And that was one of the things she said. It's still the case. It is still true that we must defend freedom of speech. One way to do it is read her essays. Read The Return of the Primitive. If you want to understand what's happening on college campuses and in the what I call the protest movement today, read that book. There is no other book, no other single resource that captures the new left and a lot of the developments in the quote on the left, but really the right has adopted a lot of the same ideas as that book, and in particular, the Cashing in the Student Rebellion. I'll put in a plug for my work and ARI's work in addition to that, and then I'll just say thanks. We have time for questions, so thanks very much, and I hope people have questions.
Thank you, Steve. This is a very timely topic, and I find it very interesting. So what particularly stood out to me is the relationship between free speech and property rights. In particular, the recent Supreme Court ruling on the Baker and the gay couple mm-hmm. seems to not address the issue of property rights insofar as they focused on the artistic license of the, mm-hmm. the Baker. So I'm wondering specifically, how do you think our legal system, particularly our Supreme Court, identifies these topics, particularly free speech and property rights and the connection?
I would say poorly. So they really don't view property rights as an aspect or an element of free speech. But I would broaden the answer and say the Supreme Court, like most other intellectuals and thinkers in this country, has a very fragmented view of rights. They don't get that really there is one right? The right to your life and the right to pursue the things necessary or take the actions necessary to sustain your life. And then there are a number of other rights that are sort of subsidiary to that. So you can think of it as the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The founders got that basic idea, but they're really indivisible. So if you violate one right, you're going to often end up violating all kinds of other rights, because oftentimes when you parcel out rights and label them differently, they're really aspects of the same kind of thing. And ultimately, they're aspects of me living my life in the world and doing stuff. So the baker is making cakes, making money, associating with other people and using speech, right? So that's liberty and activity, like economic activity, that is his use of his own property, that is the right to contract with other people, that's the right to associate with other people, and it's the right to free speech. So I've described the masterpiece cake shop as involving Yeah, the right to free speech, kind of. It's actually the least sort of obvious point. It's the right of association. He should have the right to associate with whomever he wishes, and as a corollary to that, to not associate with whomever he wishes. He should have the right to do business with people and not do business some with and not do business with others. He should have the right of freedom of conscience, meaning he should have the right not only to believe the ideas that he believes, but to put them into practice. And part of the way you put your ideas into practice is by what you choose to do, by what kinds of activities you choose to engage in, by the people that you choose to deal with. And that's a very important part of morality. I mean, Ayn Rand talked about the whole idea of sanctioning evil or aiding evil. And you can do that in so many different ways. And one of the worst ways that people do it is by giving their moral approval to ideas that they think are wrong. And it's certainly the worst when the ideas really are wrong or when the people are wrong. So the baker, I mean, leave aside what he actually believes, I would call it silly. I don't think it's the same thing to say, you know, this is exactly like the civil rights, you know, movement, segregation. I don't think it's the same thing. But one can argue with that. It doesn't ultimately matter. The bottom line is this. The guy has to have a right to make his ideas and his actions consistent with one another. And if he doesn't, his own intellectual freedom is being grossly violated. So the case of the law in the case is an example of, I think, a gross violation of intellectual freedom, which includes, if you remember Ayn Rand's essay for the New Intellectual, it's that essentially property and economic rights and intellectual and civil rights go together, right? I can't remember the exact quote. A free mind and a free market are corollaries is the point, but there's a longer quote there. But her point is we need both. I mean, it comes back to a basic philosophical issue. We're not divided minds and bodies. We're integrated minds and bodies. We have to think and we have to act. And morality applies to both of those things. So yeah, the courts don't get that at all. I won't say more about the case itself than that. Come to the Supreme Court panel next Tuesday and you can hear what I think and what others think about the case. But yeah, the Supreme Court does not get that. But they're not alone. It's not like the courts are, you know, the only ones who don't get this. Nobody really gets this.
Thank you.
You mentioned in regard to the 1964 incident that the students were using the campus as a staging area for sit-ins at local businesses. I was wondering if there's like a relevant backstory there. Was there like a specific motivation they
had? Yeah, there was. So okay. I should have made that clear. So basically what they were doing is they were sitting in or occupying the property of businesses that they thought either, in essence, weren't doing enough about civil rights or were exacerbating the problem. So some of them were businesses that had that were national chains and had had stores or whatever, businesses in the South. And the students thought, you're not doing enough to combat what's happening in the South, in the segregated South. There might have been some valid criticism there. Another was, you're not hiring enough black people at the time, although you could think about it as more minorities, both of which might be legitimate reasons to criticize the businesses. They are not legitimate reasons to occupy their property. You know, there is no legitimate reason short of like rebellion and civil, you know, mass civil unrest that's happening because the government is falling apart. Even then, it's not really, you know, I won't go into that, but the bottom line is the fact that you think that they're behaving badly doesn't give you a right to violate their property rights, and yet that's what was going on. And then there's the second point of the idea that Berkeley in 1964 was just like Alabama or Mississippi in 1964 is utterly idiotic. It's not to say that racism wasn't prevalent in the country, but there's a big difference between those two things.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey. I was wondering if you could contrast the free speech implications of the protest movement you talked about with the other mass protests that occurred within the last decade. I'm thinking of the Tea Party protests, which don't seem to raise the same kind of issues.
Yeah, it depends. You know, let me think about this. So I don't think, to my knowledge, I don't think the Tea Party movement generally, you know, quote, occupied other people's property. My sense of them was that they were fairly civilized. Oftentimes, now, and so there's two, let me just quickly talk about two things. One, there was a giant march in D.C. And then two, there were all kinds of other rallies in various places. I didn't pay close enough attention to see whether they were, you know, using property that was rented, although oftentimes I think they were. At the very least, they were getting permits. They weren't violating, you know, the law. They were actually doing this in an orderly, sensible way. And I should say that there are all kinds of mechanisms now whereby one can have mass demonstrations or whatever you want to call it, just a mass sort of get-together, a rally, let's say. And you do it by, you know, you apply to the government and they allow you to use the space. And so that's, I mean, I don't, there's nothing wrong with doing that kind of thing. And one could envision even white supremacists doing something like that in Charlottesville, although it's a slightly different issue there. But that wasn't what they were interested in Charlottesville. They were interested in mass intimidation. And I think the legal strictures on that kind of thing should be a little bit more stringent than they are. You know, if the people, like, it would have been perfectly appropriate for the judge in Charlottesville to say, yeah, you can have a quiet demonstration somewhere. I'm not going to let you surround the statue of Robert E. Lee and sort of intimidate people. You can go off to some corner of the park. It's got to be peaceful. No football helmets. No sticks. You know, just have a peaceful demonstration, and then we can all ignore you if we want. Or, I mean, they wouldn't say that. But the bottom line is that's very different from allowing them to kind of have free reign. Or, and what I'm ultimately getting at is, it's if we take Charlottesville as an appropriate exercise of free speech, that's really where the problem is. So my sense of the Tea Parties was they were much more civil. They respected people's property. I remember hearing reports that they, you know, cleaned up after themselves, et cetera. So I think it was a different kind of movement. But I would say in all cases, no matter who it is that's engaging in this kind of mass protesting, in a sense, I would put my view as, I don't think that government should be providing anybody with a forum. I would have no problem with government abolishing all public forums entirely, and I don't think it would have one bit of an impact adversely on people's ability to speak. It's just not, you know, I don't think it's necessary at all. But given that we have it, it has to be orderly and lawful. It can't be lawlessness. Does that answer the question? I mean,
yeah, I think so. I just wanted to raise it as an example.
Yeah, I mean, there's much more one could say about the difference in methods and demeanor of these of all kinds of movements. So, if we talk about the '60s civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, I mean, I'm entirely sympathetic to the cause, and their methods were brilliant compared to a lot of the New Left methods were horrifying by comparison. Although there was a lot of variation even within the civil rights movement in the 1960s. But ultimately, the question isn't what are their message, it's what do they have the right to do, and then even if we create a legal regime in which they can, say, march on public property, what are the restrictions we put on that? And we have to have restrictions on that. This idea that you just have the right to occupy public spaces whenever you want, it's absolutely out of bounds.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carl.
Good and interesting talk. I'm just curious about an implication of one of your points. Do you think there's any moral excuse or justification for mass disobedience of so-called hate speech laws, like we have in Europe?
Well, there's two questions. Is it moral, and is it... Well, let's start with the moral. Do I think there's no? Given the nature of, if a society is basically free, what I would put it at, actually, let me start over. Here's how I would put it: if you are going to engage in any kind of civil disobedience, the question you have to ask yourself is it moral? Meaning, is the cause just, and is the means am I actually respecting other people's rights? And what am I prepared to accept as the consequences? I think Martin Luther King essentially had the right approach. In other words, yes, the cause was just. The means were what? We're just going to violate the law peacefully, wait to be arrested, take the consequences, and then make a test case out of it. So if your goal is, I want to create a circumstance that can then be tried in the courts or decided in the courts, I think that's a moral approach to it. You are violating the law. You better man up and be prepared to be put in prison. So it should be a real choice and a hard choice. And part of the reason for that, I mean, if you think about it in terms of incentives and consequences, it can't just be every time I'm pissed off about something somebody does, we're going to have a mass protest and we're just going to wantonly violate the law. You better be prepared to go to prison over it and then stand before a court and say, this law has to be struck down. It has to be the exception, not the norm. I don't know what I would say about it. I mean, it's a hard one. Trying to make a decision about whether to engage in that kind of thing. I mean, personally, what I would do is I'd violate the law and then I'd go to court over it. But I don't know if I would do that in Europe because you'd probably lose. Here I would. But as a general matter, that shouldn't be the first place people's minds go. Let's violate the law and screw it, you know, and we'll force the government to bend to our will. That can't be the right approach to it. So, I mean, the short answer to your question is it's complicated and hard and you really need to think it through. But I would put it as, is the cause just, are the means just, meaning I'm not violating other people's rights, and am I prepared to go through the process that exists, a real rule of law based process to change this law? And if I'm not, I should not be doing this kind of thing.
All right, thanks.
Are you thinking about this, Carl?
No, but I meant, I can imagine a situation like, you know, a situation where you may want to publish something,
yeah,
just to stand up with,
yeah,
other people who are actually exercising their free speech, and then because they have gotten in trouble for trying to express themselves, you, yeah.
Yeah, so let me make one more distinction. If it's just a matter of opposing a law that's basically censorship, and now you're going to write something that violates the law, I mean, I think all the things that I said apply. You better be prepared to deal with the consequences of it. But that's not a circumstance that I can even imagine violating anybody else's rights. But you have to be prepared to go to court. I mean, Mark Stein is, I think, a good example in Canada, who, right, you know, they had a similar kind of hate speech law, and he wrote an article. Now, I don't know if he did it intentionally, but, you know, and then he went through the entire process. He shouldn't have had to, but it got the law, not struck off the books, but I think they withdrew the law for a number of years, and now they have it back, okay? So.
Thanks again.
Yep.
So this may be a little off topic, because it's not so much speech, but I was thinking about what you said about mass lawlessness and how that would apply to illegal immigration, where people are, you know, it's sort of individually making the decision to come, but they are breaking the law. And so how do you put that in the same category as they should be prepared to face the consequences?
I mean, ultimately, I don't think you can have a system of laws and then just say, we're not going to enforce them. But I'm against the immigration laws in their current, I guess there are two questions. One is, what do you do in response to a bad law? What is, the second is, what is the rest of, what does everybody else do in thinking about that law? So the kind of debate that often comes up in the immigration context is, they violated the law, they have to go to jail, end of debate, they're criminals, which is silly. That's not the right way to think about it. It might be they violated the law, we can't just ignore the law because we're a rule of law society. Something has to happen, but let's think about the underlying issue and now discuss that issue. So it would be two tracks. One, deal with the people who violate the law in a lawful manner that's consistent with the rule of law, i.e. we don't just sort of strip all the laws off the books the minute we don't like something happening. And number two, have a real debate. So that second part, I didn't talk about in my talk at all, but the immigration thing, I really think that when people talk about lawlessness in the immigration context, it's a way of jumping past the entire argument and just saying, hey, they're criminals, end of story. My point is not everybody who violates the law is a criminal, now we don't debate or discuss the law anymore. It's we can't condone mass lawlessness. So I always think that's true. But and there's a complicating factor in the immigration debate in that what it is that you're violating, is it a sort of short-term policy? Is it an actual law? But I think that's a sort of secondary question. Does that make
it
clear? Okay. I think that's all we have time for, so thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.